pleased to begin to welcome you all to the Tolman class of this new year. To those who have been here for years, welcome back. For those of you who have never been here before, welcome for the first time. I think we should go around the room and have Jay, you'll send around a page for you for people to just write their names on.
Already done.
Already done. Okay, you're ahead of me. But I think we should go around the room so that everybody can introduce themselves, and if there is anything that you want to add in addition to your name, this is the time to do it, and it's most welcome. Then I'll get to the material shortly. To my left is?
Brenda Goldman.
Brenda Goldman, okay.
Peter Shilagi.
Peter Shilagi.
Robert
Olden. Oh, there's somebody in back of you, Robert. You didn't have eyes behind your head. I can't understand that.
Aaron Sheldon, and I'm glad to be back. I haven't been to a Tolman class probably 7 years since we're in this building.
You might not even recognize it.
Well, what is it, though?
Okay.
Herb Shapiro.
Terrific.
Arthur Sobel.
Alan Mayer.
Laura Miskin.
Carol Ratner, and a friend of mine emailed me today, and he said, tip of the day, you can't learn the Talmud standing on one leg, which I assumed was an inside joke that I certainly didn't get, but I asked the rabbi, and maybe he'd be kind enough to explain what it is.
It goes back to the discussion between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, where a man comes and wants to convert. And he wants to do it while standing on one leg. And, of course, to Shammai, first of all, it's an insult. Hillel is much more ready to deal with this. But the key thing of saying that you want to do it on one leg is fast. I want the quick version. Everything that I have to know about Judaism. And therefore... Shammai was reticent to give him the fast version. Hillel had a formulation which he was willing to impart. Okay? So your friend was saying to you, what was the context he put that in?
He said, tip of
the day. Tip of the day. Don't learn it. You can't learn.
Learn the
on one leg. You can't learn it fast. You can't learn how did they used to say it?
The
Cliff Notes. The Cliff Notes, right. The Cliff Notes version. Yes, ma'am.
I remember the rest of the story.
I don't want to go into the rest of the story because that will take us away from our...
What Hillel said.
Yes.
That you can't... There's one sentence. Ve'ahavta le'racha kamocha v'ashar le'chulmad.
Excellent.
That was the punchline.
Good. Yes, next.
Bobby Kohler.
Barry Kohler.
Mark Ashland.
Mark Lowenthal.
Benjamin Marcus.
All right. It's a pleasure to say hello to you all again and to welcome you to this Talmud class. Now, some words, first of all, about procedure. What are we doing? What are we studying? What text do you need? And how will we go about the study of that text? We are actually not picking up where we left off last year in the study of Masechet Kiddushin. But we're skipping some material that is just very loosely connected to what we did last year. But in general, we are studying in the first chapter of the Talmudic tractate of Kiddushin. And in order to follow and learn this material, I think the most effective way of doing it is to purchase volume 1 of Tractate Kiddushin, K-I-D-D-U-S-H-I-N, in the edition of the Schottenstein Talmud. Schottenstein. Those who were in the class last year have that. The Schottenstein Talmud is available in two versions. One version is the large text, and it's exactly the same otherwise, but one is a large format. One of you have a large format, can just show us the size of that. Advantage of the large format is that it's easier to read. Then there is the smaller format, which is almost half that size, and it's harder to read, but the advantage is it's easier to carry. So, but otherwise they're exactly the same. The Schottenstein edition of the Talmud is an edition that has the classic, what we call the Vilna text, the classic Vilna text of the Talmud, and opposite that has not only a New English translation, but has an English commentary. Both the translation and the commentary are remarkably good. They're remarkably good. So good that I've been amazed every time I deal with the text at how good it is. It's not what I expected out of the Schottenstein Talmud, but it's what I got. And it's a real credit to those who were able to put this together. The only other text that I think is worthwhile to work with is what Herb is working with. Meira has it, I see. And that is the Steinsaltz edition of the Talmud, which particularly if you're comfortable in reading the Hebrew text, the Steinsaltz only in the Hebrew. I don't know whether it exists in English. Some of the volumes of the Steinsaltz Talmud do exist in English. The English is not really that worthwhile. The Hebrew is worthwhile. And you might, if Hebrew is something you're comfortable with, you might feel that you want to use that edition, which is a wonderful way also to study Talmud. So we will be studying in the Schottenstein. The way this works is that the pages, you've got the traditional Talmud text here, then that's broken up, and it's brought both in terms of the Makor, the actual Hebrew is brought here on the English side of the page, and the English translation. So it turns out that every page of the traditional text actually has several pages of English text. So the traditional text is simply repeated several times. You'll see, and therefore there's a sort of complex pagination which tries to just make it clear that the pagination is in relation to the traditional Hebrew text. Now, by traditional Hebrew text, let me say a few words about, make it clear what the volume is so that it'll be easy for you. In here, the Steinsaltz, I think, is only a one-volume Kiddushin, isn't it? It's one-volume Kiddushin. In the Schottenstein Talmud, it's a two-volume Kiddushin. You want volume one. Volume one of the Kiddushin, okay? I think chapter one is probably the entire volume. Yes, chapter one is the entire volume of volume one. And that's what we're going to be doing. That's what we will be doing, okay? Any questions on the text that we'll be using?
Could you just spell the name of the
Schottenstein?
It's actually on the website, on the Yozuru website.
That's all. Okay, if the rabbi could
S-C-H-O-T-T-E-N-S-T-E-I-N, Schottenstein. Okay?
Thank you.
S-C-H-O-T-T-E-N-S-T-E-I-N, Schottenstein. Okay? So that's the text that we'll be using. We are skipping, those of you who were in the class last year, because last year we dealt with the very basic approach to the structure of the Jewish wedding ceremony, the Kiddushin, the formal act of Kiddushin, and we found that that was an act of acquisition. And we then talked about the subject of acquisition, the terminology of acquisition. We talked about the verb lakach, ayikach otan the isha, and he took her for a wife, and the symbolic nature of acquisition in Judaism. And then acquisition as far as marriage is concerned, the nature of acquisition and the metaphor of acquisition as it is used in the context of marriage. I tried to develop a theory of the metaphor based on the biblical text. Once that metaphor, in fact, has been fully established in Masechet Kiddushin, and the subject of acquisition has been discussed as far as marriage goes, as is characteristic of the Talmud, sometimes the Talmud just enjoys where it is and it keeps going, not necessarily talking about marriage. And that's what happens. That's what happened in where we left off last year. In fact, it goes into a great deal of further discussion just about the laws of acquisition. While that's interesting if you're studying Talmud, it's not my particular area of interest because I'm more interested in the subject of marriage and those things related to marriage. Again, as is characteristic of the Talmud eventually gets back to its initial subject, but only after going on several different tangents. The next tangent, after simply going further with the subject of acquisition as an issue of law, is a tangent that you will find begins with the Mishnah on Daf Kaftet Amud Aleph, page 29a. And it is 29a1 for those of you who are following along in the Schottenstein Talmud. Now, there, the Talmud begins a new Mishnah. I'm going to define terms for the sake of those of you who are not used to these terms, so I ask the indulgence of those of you for whom this is something that does not need any definition. The Talmud structurally is made up of two parts. One is Mishnah, the other is Gemara. Mishnah, Gemara. The Mishnah is the earlier, more or less earlier from the perspective of the editing of the text of these two components. Roughly speaking, we date the Mishnah at the year 200 CE, edited by Rabbi Judah the Prince. Okay? Rabbi Judah the Prince is not the source of all the things in the Mishnah, by no means, but he puts it into a form which becomes known as Mishnah, 200 CE. Once that Mishnah is in its form, then it is studied as Mishnah and elucidated in roughly the following 300 years. During that time of the Gemara, how I've used the term Gemara, which is elucidation of the Mishnah, the Gemara elucidates the Mishnah in a wide variety of ways. Among them, sometimes it cites contemporaneous sources with the Mishnah. Those are called baraitot. Baraitot. Baraita means outside of. It is outside of the Mishnah, but contemporaneous with the Mishnah. So if we are reading something that is a baraita, we know roughly its time period. By roughly, I mean roughly, in most cases, a 200-year, from 0 to 200, roughly. Not always, but most of the time that's true. And because it's a baraita, it's been left out of the Mishnah. So some of the things that we have in the Gemara in order to elucidate the Mishnah involve baraitot.
What's the meaning of baraita?
Outside. Chutzmi. Okay? Baraita means outside. Outside.
Bar mina.
Exactly. Bar in Aramaic is outside.
What's the meaning of Mishnah?
Study. Study. It comes from the root shin nun he. Shin nun he. The same root as you have for a word such as shana. shana. And what is characteristic about the shana? It is repetitive. As in the Hebrew number, shnayim. It's in the same root. Right? Sheni, second. It's a repetition of something. So that in the Shema, for example, the Shema says, among other things, Vishinantam Levanecha. For more or less the same root, Shana, Shnayim, Shinantam, you shall repeat them to your children. And that came to mean you shall teach them to your children. Classic in Hebrew is the addition of a mem at the beginning of a word to create from a verb a noun. And one of the common things you have in Hebrew are words like Mishnah. It's a noun from the verb of Shana or Shina or Shinan, which means repeating, place of repetition, which becomes a source of teaching. Okay? So the Mishnah then is a corpus of teaching.
Could now, it be secondary to the Torah? Because it's Sheni?
It could be. It could be. It could be, but I'm not sure that it is meant in that way. It is meant, in fact, as the source of teaching. The source of teaching. Yes, in later Hebrew it comes to have that meaning. Well, not only later, because also Mishneh Torah in Rabbinic Hebrew refers to the book of Deuteronomy. Mishneh Torah in Maimonidean Hebrew refers to his code of Jewish law. So there, in both those cases, it does mean a second Torah. Okay, a second Torah. But I think that the use made of it by Rabbi Judah the Prince, the extent that he actually used the term, surely the term was used by others, is that this is then the central corpus of teaching. I'm going to say a little bit more that about that, and almost the theology of Mishnah, which I've never really said too much about, but I think it's interesting, particularly as we read this Mishnah that we're going to read tonight. But I'll say that later. So far, I just want to define terms. So Mishnah is dated roughly at 200 CE. It involves a corpus of the law, published, as it were, by Rabbi Judah the Prince. Okay, he is the leader both politically and intellectually in the land of Israel in 200 CE, lives in Tiberias. Okay? The Gemara elucidates that, firstly by citations to contemporaneous sources with the Mishnah. Secondly, in the Gemara contains a great deal of study of the Mishnah or of Baraitot in order to do something with them, to elucidate them in one way or another. Sometimes it will be in order to figure out what they're saying. Sometimes it will be in order to elucidate an abstract issue, which is the concern of the Gemara. For example, the Gemara may be interested in the meaning of kiddushin. Or the Gemara may be interested in the nature of acquisition. How do you acquire something? What does it mean to acquire? What is, even in English, the term is a loaded term to acquire. It means that suddenly you have control over something. Does it mean that, necessarily? Well, all of those things may be elucidated, and they may be elucidated sometimes by reference to earlier sources, such as Baraitot, but they may be elucidated sometimes according to certain reflections. Reflective thinking is also a part of this tradition. And therefore, in the 3rd century, in the 4th century, in the 5th century, well unto the beginning of the 6th century, there are many such reflections. Give and take in the Talmud. Shakla and Tarya, you say it in Aramaic. Masa Matan in Hebrew. A give and take. And that may be, you never know exactly where it's going. Sometimes it's clear, sometimes it's not clear, but that's part and parcel of the Talmudic method, is to study things in such a way. You see more of that in the Gemara than you will in the Mishnah. You'll see relatively little of it in the Mishnah, but you do have it in the Mishnah of give and take. Frequently in the Mishnah, you'll have so-and-so says this and so-and-so says that, but you won't see the dynamics. The dynamics. Sometimes when you read the Gemara, you'll really be getting an insight into either what happened in the classroom, or somebody's reconstruction of either what happened, or should have happened, or might have happened in the classroom. As you read it, you'll say to yourself, yeah, I'm not sure, what am I reading? Am I reading an argument between two people? Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes you're reading something that could have been an argument between two people, or four people, or six people. Or sometimes you have the feeling it's one person just trying to analyze something from every side. Variety of possibilities. But this is characteristic now of the Gemara. Gemara. Remember again, we have Mishnah and Gemara. Together, the Mishnah and the Gemara make up what we refer to as the Talmud. Okay? So when you refer to the Talmud, in fact, is usually referring to both of those together. Sometimes when you say Talmud, it's referring to just the Gemara. But when you're referring to a book that you would buy, for example, buy me a Talmud, that means the Mishnah and the Gemara together. Okay? Now, hold on. The Talmud itself covers the entire, well, much of the corpus. If not the entire corpus of Jewish law, much of the corpus of Jewish law. Simply because the Mishnah, in fact, covers the corpus of the law. The Talmud is divided into orders, sedarim, orders, and tractates, masechtot. Masechtot. Okay? Orders and tractates. There are six orders of the Mishnah, and many, many tractates underneath those six orders. Okay? The orders of the Mishnah, the Sedarim, you know the word Seder? The word Sedarim, the six orders of the Mishnah, actually cover the entire corpus of the law. They do cover it. They begin with Zemanim, laws of times, laws of...
What's of? I don't know.
I'm sorry, not Zemanim. Zeraim. I'm thinking of the Rosh Tevot. What do you say in English? You say the anagram, the...
Mnemonic,
right. The mnemonic is Manakat. The first of the orders is Zeraim, which are is the order of seeds. Dealing with all the agricultural laws. In fact, in the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, which is the one that we are studying now, which is the more studied of the Talmuds, edited in Babylonia, the Babylonian Talmud has only one tractate in the order of Zeraim. Only one tractate. The first, the brachot, blessings. Because blessings deal, among other things, with the subject of foods, which has to do with agriculture to some extent. The rest of Zeraim, of the agricultural laws, have no Gemara in the Babylonian Talmud, as in an ordered form. You find them in the Jerusalem Talmud. There is also a Jerusalem Talmud. Not the one we would be referring to, not the principal one that's been studied. Okay? So that's Zeraim. Then the second one is Moed. Moed are laws of times. We studied Moed Katan, for example, which dealt with the intermediate days of the festivals and the laws of mourning. That is the second of the orders. The third is Nashim, women. all those areas that have in any way to deal with women. Okay? The Tractate of Kiddushin is one of the tractates, one of the Masechtot, that is part of the order of Nashim. Then you go to Nizikin, damages, the civil law, the criminal laws found in Nizikin. Kuf, Kodoshim, the laws of sacrifices, including those, as it were, shchitot, sacrifices or slaughtering of animals for non-sacred purposes. There's where you find all the laws of kashrut, for example. In the order of Kodashim. In the final section, the final order of the Mishnah is Tohorot. Tohorot, purities. And there also most of the orders of the, most of the tractates of the Mishnah do not have Gemara. They do not have Gemara. The one that has Gemara is Nida, which are laws of purity. Okay, so these are the, this is the basic structure of the Talmud. Any edition of the Talmud, if you look, for example, right in front of me, Or Zarua's first purchase of, the first book that we bought was a Talmud. That was done with a malice aforethought, the thought being that that should be the first thing you buy. So the first thing we did was bought a Talmud. That Talmud happens to be the last Talmud published in America of the traditional type. No more Talmuds were published after that. That was the last Talmud published in New York. New York has a vast history of Hebrew publications. It's over. It's over. The only things that are published now are things that, like the Schottenstein, which involve essentially English. But the last, this is the only time, the only way you can buy a Hebrew Talmud today is Israeli publications. We have the last one, that's the Grossman Otzah Sfarim was the last one published in New York. So that goes back, or so it was 20 years old, so that's 20 years old. And they published that, that had just come out 20 years ago. And when that ran out, that was the end. That was the end of Talmudic publication in New York, at least of the traditional form of the Talmud. Although what they're doing in Israel is actually quite good now. The Israeli publications are adding more commentaries. This edition has the commentary of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. That's its most up-to-date commentary. The Israeli ones are adding new things, as most editions of the Talmud, when they come out, usually add new things, including textual emendations, which are in the Israeli editions. But the value of this one, and it's changed a little bit now, is that this is the last really well-bound Talmud. Because it, particularly in those days, it's improved. The Israelis have improved enormously in terms of their binding. But it used to be that if you bought books in Israel 20 to 30 years ago, the paper was awful and the binding was worse. That's no longer the case. They've developed the technology, so I wouldn't say that anymore. But at the time that this was being published, this kind of binding was, this is the last of the American bindings of the Talmud. You just don't see that anymore. Now you have to have it specially done.
Is it appropriate to share with us the derivation of Peter, who published the Talmud? The prince?
Judah the prince.
What was the impetus to do that, and how was there, I assume there was some level of study.
Well, let me just tell you, I'll answer that, and I'll give you a short answer, and then later on I'll probably give you a longer answer. Short answer is, in the year 200, realize what was going on in the land of Israel. The classic answer is that in the year 200, you had just, roughly the year 130 was the date, 130, 132, the date of the Hadrianic persecutions. So Rome was ruling in the Middle East. Not only was Rome ruling, but Rome had a very problematic group of people on their hands, and that was the Jews. The Jews, for some strange reason, objected to a lot of things that other people didn't seem to object to. For example, Jews objected to idols being placed in their temple. Generally speaking, in the Roman world, people didn't really mind those things. They figured, this is cool. This is a little bit of upper-class Roman influence. You know, we're open to new things. The Jews went bananas. The Jews are not very tolerant of these things. So the Romans and the Jews were at loggerheads. And in the Jewish community, that's going back 200 years. But 200 years, I mean 200 years before Rabbi Judah the Prince. Question was, what were the Romans going to do and what were the Jews going to do? Where was this all going? Well, in fact, there was a meltdown. There was a true meltdown. And Rome decided that the only way to deal with this particular community was to demolish its leadership and its institutions. The principal institution was the temple in Jerusalem. Well, the temple in Jerusalem was one of the great buildings of the ancient world. It had few comparable buildings. I don't think that there is anything that you see in Rome today that, I don't know exactly how much of what you see in Rome today represents the best of what was in Rome in Roman times. Surely what you see in Greece, for example, some of the Greek buildings, something like the Parthenon, you know, you're talking that level of building is what Herod, in fact, had done in Jerusalem. Well, Rome decided to put the torch to the whole thing because they felt that the only way they could really have hegemony in that particular piece of the world was by ending totally all Jewish hegemony. Well, that was calamitous for the Jewish community. It was so calamitous that the Jews didn't recover until 60 years ago. 60 years ago was the real recovery, but I mean it had begun roughly 160 years ago. The development of modern Zionism. But that's a long time. That's a long time. You're talking 1900 years of trying to restore something. And obviously after 1900 years you can never restore what was. But that's the rough background. The rabbis in that period were of different minds. Some of whom felt that Rome should be fought. Some of whom felt that Rome should be compromised with. So rabbis, as is frequently the case of rabbis, run the gamut in terms of their politics. All that having been said, the facts on the ground were that by the year 200 CE, the Jewish community had lost this central place of Jewish worship in 70 CE. In 130, 60 years later, the rebellion of Bar Kokhba, which was the last real political rebellion, occurs in about 132. That is successfully put down by Rome. So you're dealing with a series of political calamities that have a tremendous impact on the nation. Frankly, most nations would cease to exist after such political calamities. Part and parcel of this nation was that it had for quite some while, from the period of Ezra, roughly now, very roughly, 500 BCE. Okay? 500 BCE to 200 CE. A more or less continuous intellectual tradition that developed over a 700-year period of time that had a number of effects. Among the effects was the development of a class of scholars who had sometimes political leadership, sometimes they didn't have political leadership, it varied. But that's a long period of time, too, 700 years. Okay? By the time you get to the final Roman victory over Bar Kokhba and the rabbis who stood with him, you know these rabbis because we weren't so long ago in Yom Kippur. We read the martyrology. That's who we're talking about. These are the people. It's the people like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan. Right? These are the people of our martyrology. That's roughly now 130 to 135 CE, 60 to 70 years before the Mishnah. Now, if you had an intellectual tradition, and you had sort of both a political and intellectual structure for your community, and things had calmed down some after that, I would think that it would be a tremendously important thing to do for someone with both the intellectual knowledge as well as the political wherewithal to actually at that time, some 60 to 70 years after this destruction, somebody...
It's in a code.
All right, forget it. Don't pay no attention. After that time, to come up with something that everybody could study, to come up with a centralized corpus that in fact would be useful. That's what he does. Rabbi Judah the Prince was someone who was wealthy. We call him the Prince. I don't know whether that's Prince the way we think of Prince. He was the leader, both secularly and intellectually, of the community. And he is dealing with something that didn't just happen in his own time. As I said, I went back to 500 BCE to sort of give you the beginning of a rabbinic tradition. Normally, we see this tradition as going back 200 BCE. Right? We see the beginnings of what we call the Tannaitic period. The teachers of the Mishnah or the Baraita are called Tannaim. Tanna. A Tanna is a teacher of that period. Right? That's a long time, no matter how you calculate it. If you calculate it as 400 years, if you calculate it as 500 years, if you calculate it as 700 years, it's a long time, no matter how you do it. But after the political calamities, the end of Jewish dominion, right? The population still more or less lives there, to some extent at least, but they have no power anymore. Rome is the power. So Rabbi Judah the Prince really reconstitutes, in a very important way, the tradition. I think it was a necessary thing, and it was a valuable thing. Okay? So that's the classic understanding of what was. I may say this is something a little bit different. We have a little bit more time a little later. Yes?
And the follow-up to that, supposedly the Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmud, was that there was more of a Jewish community in Babylon at the time, after 200 CE?
Okay. Remember that the Babylonian Jewish community is a very, very old Jewish community. The Babylonian Jewish community doesn't end until about 1950. It has a continuous Jewish community from roughly 586 BCE, even before that, because there was a prior exile. So from roughly that time, of the first destruction of the first temple, until about 1950, roughly the early 50s. That's amazing. The Jewish community that goes to Babylonia, some of it returns roughly 70 years after the destruction of the first temple. Right? Some of that community returns, not all of it. And it becomes a major community living in Babylonia, as I said, until recent times. Until recent times. So the Jewish community lives there. It receives more or less the same Mishnah. Once Rabbi Judah the Prince edits it. But there are a variety of reasons why the study in Babylonia becomes the principal study. Most having to do with really subsequent history, having to do with the Arabic period, and the fact that Babylonia becomes the center of the caliphate. And politically it becomes the center, therefore, of all of North Africa as well as the Middle East. Okay? And as a result of that, there's a continuity in Babylonia which doesn't exist really in the land of Israel. The land of Israel is subject, there isn't the political center in the land of Israel that exists in Babylonia. And therefore there's a break in continuity. In a legal system, continuity is really very important because laws really show the influence of time. And if you have a break in that, it can be a disastrous break. But if you don't have a break in that, if you have a continuity there, then it can be of enormous significance. And in fact, that's what happens in Babylonia. The Babylonian Jewish community, not necessarily better, but it has more continuity. And as a result of the continuity, it also has institutions. And institutions and the continuity of leadership and of texts has, over time, a decisive impact. Yes, ma'am?
It's amazing to me that if the scholarly tradition went back to 500 BCE, that it wasn't until 200 CE that something like this was codified. I mean, you would think, okay, that in the ensuing 700 years, someone would have gotten around to doing this.
Maybe yes and maybe no. First of all, you're thinking like somebody who lives in the world of paper and who's used to reading things. Keep in mind that the reality of the ancient world was not a world of books and paper. It was a world, first of all, of study that was primarily oral in nature. When we say even that Rabbi Judah the Prince edited the Mishnah, it's not exactly clear what that statement means. Whether that means he edited it and kept a written copy of it, or whether he edited it and in fact promulgated an oral copy of it. Right? Both are potentially possible. But I think that what you have to keep in mind is the fact that in the ancient world, learning was primarily oral and not written. Primarily oral and not written. Just as a matter of mechanics, the way things were done. Okay? Where you have oral communication, also the nature of schooling is different. The nature of schooling is different in that you are dependent upon people who are able to transmit the oral tradition effectively. That may or may not mean that they are the ones who have much insight into it. Even the term Tana, for example, is used technically to refer to somebody who was more or less a wind-up memorizer. If the rabbis wanted somebody to lead the session, they turned the Tana on. I more or less say, take from the second Mishnah of the third chapter, please, Tana, go. Tana would then say it. Tana had a mind that was very good for memorization. People who are very good at memorization doesn't mean at all that they know what they're talking about. Or that they even should know what they're talking about. Because the problem with somebody who knows what he's talking about is that he could change the text. Because he could say the text, I don't understand this text, I'll make it better. And in an oral tradition, the purity of the oral tradition is something that is in itself a sacrosanct thing. Okay? So when we say that Rabbi Judah the Prince edited something, first of all, the likelihood is that there were many, many other things going on over that wide, long period of time before that. Question is, what? Well, the answer is, I really don't know, except on the basis of the evidence that is written evidence, because evidence that's oral evidence is gone. So you only know the written evidence. The written evidence is deceiving, because the written evidence only tells us written things. And from all that we can gather, the tradition was largely oral. So we do know in some of the written sources that we have, and we have a lot of written sources, a lot of references made to other sources. So that even Rabbi Judah the Prince's edition of the Mishnah, he didn't make it up. Right? It was based on a lot of other things. And a lot of the rabbinic scholarship over the last 200 years really has been devoted to trying to ferret that out from the written sources that we have that we can in some way date. What conclusions can we draw about what went into the Mishnah? Okay? So a lot of that has been sort of hard-nosed effort to pump the written sources for whatever they might yield. At a certain point in the rabbinic studies, what's also happens kind of interesting is that that's sort of been squeezed for everything that it can get. So that something now, a little bit different is happening now. Most recent layer of rabbinic studies is what you do after you pump all your sources. You begin to speculate. That's what you do. You speculate because you don't really have any sources. You've looked at all the sources. Unless you find a new source, it's already been done. So instead, what's happening now is the layer of speculation. There's more speculation. Well, we don't have any sources, but, and you begin to construct. What scientists will often do is to construct a theoretical framework which seems to be highly plausible. And as long as the written sources don't contradict it, you've got something going. If it tends through a plausible intellectual framework to explain a lot of unknown things. Professor David Weiss Halivni is perhaps the foremost practitioner of this type of study. Mark, you studied with Halivni. Did he teach in his classes that you studied his methodology?
Yes, although it was more implicit in his teaching.
Yeah. When I studied with Halivni, he, of course, wanted to teach us how to study Talmud. So a lot of it was just the mechanics of Talmud study. But then, of course, he had his own methodology. And what Halivni has been doing is to create these highly plausible frameworks, some of which are based on very careful study of the text. Well, what's going on now, what Olivia has done over the last few years, is to begin to create almost historical frameworks based, again, on the plausibility of a certain type of history leading to the text that we have. And he has put on this, most recently, a theological framework as well to try and derive some theological meaning from the process of the transmission of the text. Any other questions? Okay, so that was the answer to your question. Okay. Now what we are going to do is to pick up on a Mishnah that is well nigh about halfway through the first chapter of the text. It's actually more than halfway through in terms of the Gemara, because once the rabbis are interested in laws of acquisition, they get very interested in laws of acquisition. But this is a Mishnah which begins a section now of the first tractate, first chapter of Kiddushin, which goes back to the initial subject in the most general way, but doesn't really. This Mishnah begins a series of Mishnayot that really deal with a related but not the same subject as marriage. The related issues are wives, parents, and children. Now, obviously, they're related to the general subject of the laws of acquisition and of marriage, but they're not precisely that. And as is the nature of the Talmud, to say that they're not precisely that means they're not precisely that. They could be anything. It could be all kinds of things. But somehow they will relate to this subject. Now, this Mishnah is in a way a very simple Mishnah. But in a way, it's a very difficult Mishnah. And I want to say a word about reading Talmud that is something that some of you understand because you've done it for a while. But until you've done this for a while, it's not at all obvious. And that is that I want to emphasize to you that the Talmud is its own world. It's its own world. And it's a world. We speak of Yama Talmud, the sea of the Talmud. It's its own sea, S-E-A. When you study the Talmud, you are going into a very different world. It's not our world. It bears some relation to our world because there is no doubt about the fact that the Talmud is the corpus that is the central corpus, together with the Bible, of the Jewish religion. Okay? Having said that, once you go into the world of the Talmud, you will see things that never would have occurred to you before because it's such a different world. Now, usually when you go spelunking and you go places where you never would go before, or you're a tourist, it's always kind of interesting because it's weird. And for a while, the more something is weird, the better it is. Now, I know people who these days, very few people from this congregation go, you know, except, and they go to London because they go to the theater in London. But if, not because they haven't been to London before. There's some people, yes. But most people are going to Vietnam these days, or to India, because they're well-traveled. They're well-traveled. And there are places to which the well-traveled person goes. And the more and more, well, at least that was the case before this last economic thing. I don't know, maybe we'll go back to going downtown, the current environment. Get to know your own city. Go to Borough Park. That's where you'll go. Instead of Hyde Park, go to Borough Park. Right? So, it's interesting. It's interesting to travel. It's interesting to travel to exotic places. So to some extent, the Talmud is exotic. And it's weird. I say that before you read anything. The Talmud can be extremely weird. The way of thinking is not our most common way of thinking. The subject matter will frequently surprise you, the nature of the subject matter. But in a way, that's one of its charms. It's one of the charms of the Talmud. I would say that for the modern reader, perhaps the most difficult areas of the Talmud have nothing to do with the abstruseness of the material. It very frequently is when the Talmud talks about things that you or I may talk about, but very differently. You will find that the Talmud sometimes deals with subjects that you, in fact, are talking about, but in ways that are so different from the way you normally formulate your ideas that you'll have a variety of reactions to the way the Talmud deals with the subject. Now, why do I give you this introduction? Because there are a few hot-button issues of our day. I would say probably the number one hot-button issue still in the Jewish community is probably women, subject of women. And it's therefore very difficult to approach academically. I say that as somebody who likes to study subjects with a fair degree of objectivity, number one, and number two, actually to go beyond that, to deal with theological issues. There are issues that are very difficult to deal with that way. Perhaps the most common one is the subject of women. It is not possible, usually, to discuss that subject seriously in terms of the traditional literature, usually, because people are not open to it. They are too involved in the issue to be able to have any objectivity. And religious issues that are pressing issues are frequently issues that people cannot have any distance from. So that whereas one of the normal positive values of Talmud is that it is so distant that it is exotic, there are sections of the Talmud which are not that exotic. Rather, they may hit home. I do think that if one will give the Talmud a fair chance, and one will do with this material exactly the same thing that we do with any other material, and that we approach it historically, anthropologically, theologically, and textually, we will come to the same level of intuition and knowledge about this subject as any other subject. I think actually it's more difficult, because in a way it's more relevant. Okay? It's more difficult, therefore, to deal with. That is my apologetic before reaching the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah is going to deal with a subject that is more or less incomprehensible to most modern Jews. And I say that to you honestly, because I have lived through my own experience of seeing that in, for example, the conservative rabbinate, I believe the subject is more or less incomprehensible. And I say that to you with all honesty. I found that out for the first time, let's see, I finished the seminary in 1971, I began to teach there in 1972. So that's 36 to 7 years ago. 36 to 7 years ago, the subject of women in the rabbinate became the hot issue at the seminary. And for a period of about 3 years, it was a major, major issue. And finally, there was a certain decision that was made. During that period of time, I was studying this subject theologically with Professor Gerson Cohn. And I had done studies in the theology of the nature of sexuality, of religion, the way in which religion deals with sexuality. And I thought this was a very interesting and important subject. I remember at that time going to a meeting of the Rabbinical Assembly, which was the organization of conservative rabbis, who put in their two cents on the subject of women in the rabbinate. And I was appalled. Not with the conclusion, because I happen to have had the same conclusion myself, but with the methodology. I saw that the rabbis were able to deal with this question only from the perspective of where American society was and the way in which American society was dealing with the subject. They were completely clueless about any other way of dealing with the subject, and one would have hoped that in a religious tradition as old and as all-encompassing as ours, there was something to say. But the rabbis were totally unable to deal with that. So that was my first experience as a graduate student. I had been ordained already. I was back in the seminary as a PhD student, wanting to save the world for theology, and assuming that if we could articulate a theological concept, it would be the most important thing that could be done. I found that that was nearly completely wrong. People had absolutely no interest in that subject. That rather, people were able only to see it from where their personal experience was. Which is not necessarily bad, but it was the fact. It was the fact. The subject of this Mishnah, as you will see, is the subject of mitzvot and the relative way in which some or all of the mitzvot are incumbent on women or on men. And they are different. They are different. So that you will see to begin with that the Mishnah presupposes certain things that frankly most modern people would never presuppose. And this is a presupposition of the Mishnah. I will deal with the Mishnah in terms of what it says. Over the course of the year, I hope that we will be able to fill out the theological background to that. Because it must be something compelling if it is such a central subject of the Mishnah. It will be quite different than what one might have constructed if one simply began from where the modern world is. It is quite different. We are on page 29A1. This is Kaf Tet Amud Aleph. Every page in the Talmud is paginated with an A and a B page. The page itself has a page number, and that's a folio page with a side A and a side B. So that if you look here on the traditional Hebrew text, this is the A side of the page. And somewhere down, actually it's better if you look at the traditional text, the opposite side of the page is the bet side or the B side. Okay? Also, just before we get into it, when you're looking at the traditional page of the Talmud itself, Mishnah and Gemara, is in the middle of the page. It's in the middle of the page. Okay? In the middle of the page, that's it. What's around it are the commentaries. Everything that around it is commentary. The principal commentary to the Talmud is Rashi from the 11th century, Rabbi Shmuel Yitzhaki, Samuel ben Isaac. Ashlam. Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rabbi Solomon ben Isaac, thank you, is Rashi, 1040 to 1105 in France. Okay? 1040 to 1105 in France. That is the principal commentary. On the opposite side of the Talmud text are the Tosafot, additional commentaries, which are the commentaries more or less of the generation two and sometimes three after Rashi in France. Okay? So we have largely French commentaries here. Largely French commentaries from what we would call the early Middle Ages. Early Middle Ages. You cannot understand the Talmud text without reference to the Rashi. Frequently you can understand it without the Tosafot. Sometimes the Tosafot can mix you up. You can't possibly understand it without the Rashi. Rashi is basic to the understanding of the text. The Talmud is elliptical. It's a shorthand, frequently. And you need a tradition of explanation that fills in all the empty spaces. Rashi, to a great extent, does that. Of course, all the other commentators for a few thousand years help. And in a full edition of the Talmud, as you've got over there, you've got tons of those commentators, and most of them are in the back and not on the page. We'll be making reference to things on the page from time to time, principally Rashi, but not only Rashi. Okay? Yes?
Did Rashi come up with the Nova, or did he kind of just summarize other people from before him?
I assume that he was summarizing people from before him. Rashi was not an innovative commentator. Rashi was an extraordinary commentator because he brought as much as he did to the table and was able to articulate and to edit things in a readily accessible form. Rashi, remember, studied in the yeshivot of the Rhineland, which was where rabbinic tradition had moved to, the Rhineland. He studied in the Rhineland. He came from Troyes, Champagne. So he studied in the Rhineland, moved the tradition in the major centers to Troyes, where he was. And then the Rhineland, toward the end of Rashi's life, goes through, again, a period of calamity. Because the First Crusade comes down the Rhine River. And one of the things that the Crusaders did was they tried to kill as many Jews as they could on the way. So the Jewish communities in the Rhineland are devastated. Well, in the meantime, the tradition of the Rhineland has moved to Troyes, to Champagne. Rashi was one of the great intellectuals of the Middle Ages. When you talk about the Dark Ages, we never had those Dark Ages. Dark Ages, I'm sure, they refer to a lot of things happening in Christian Europe. But surely, as far as the Jewish community goes, there's no darkness at all. The only darkness was in the long winters. And that's when Rashi did a lot of his work. He did a lot of his work in the winters. He was a vintner. He planted wines, I'm sure made champagne. Rashi is one of the best sources of medieval French viniculture, as well as the French language in the 11th century. Because Rashi would occasionally translate words from Hebrew into French. And Rashi is the only source that we have for French pronunciation in the 11th century. How do you know how French was pronounced in the 11th century? Only enough from Rashi. Because Rashi wrote French in Hebrew characters. If you wrote French in French characters, you have no idea how they were pronounced, because they're a modern Frenchman will tell you the same. The way he pronounces it is the way it was pronounced 800 years ago, 900 years ago. But if you have them suddenly in a totally different alphabet, for which there is continuity, then suddenly you know how French was pronounced. You know the letters that were left out, you know the silent letters, because we know whether they're in his Hebrew transliterations of French. So, just an amazing thing. But Rashi had this talent to say things in a succinct manner. Very, very few teachers know how to do that. Very few. It's an incredible thing that Rashi was able to do. We have such a long tradition. To be able to cull from that tradition things that are important, and enough people agree with you that they are important, and to say them in a way that succinctly conveys meaning, well, it was so amazing that since Rashi, the only one who's ever been able to come near that was Adin Steinsaltz, who started this whole project about 40, 50 years ago. Steinsaltz is the only one who's been able to do that. Nobody else in all of the years has been able to do that. So it's an incredible feat. He did it for the entire Bible. And in the Bible commentary, we know his Bible commentary is not at all original. It's totally dependent on secondary sources. I shouldn't say totally. It's mostly dependent on secondary sources. But he had a methodology. He was a fantastic teacher. Fantastic teacher. His Bible commentary, always sensitive to problems in the text. And if you study Bible with Rashi, with a good teacher of Rashi, you learn how to read Rashi, because Rashi is always reacting to some problem in the text. I learned Rashi first with a great teacher, Professor Nechama Leibovich, who was one of the greatest teachers of Rashi in the world. Those of us who studied with Nechama Leibovich, as she was my teacher in the Hebrew University, absolutely no better teacher of Rashi ever. And people around attest to this. Rabbi Luchstein, he studied with her. I studied with her. We are all Nechama Leibovich's students. Not to say we only studied with her, but she was the master of teaching you how to read Rashi. Because Rashi had a methodology. So sometimes that methodology is creative in that you see Rashi coming through. But most of what Rashi does is based on prior sources. Okay?
Yes. The commentary on the very rim of the page.
Mm-hmm. What is that? Okay. Very rim, let's say, very rim means there are two rims, of course.
No, well,
we've got one rim on this side and we've got one rim on that side. Okay?
Yes.
So they're not the same. They're not the same. Each has its place. Over here is Ner Mishpat, Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah. These are what we would call the footnotes to the later codes. Footnotes to the later codes. So when we find something in the Mishnah or in the Gemara that has been later codified by the codifiers of the law, for example, Maimonides in his Mishneh Torah, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, Katan, different codes that developed over time, after the time of the Talmud. If you want to look it up and see how this was codified, this is how you look it up. This gives you the footnotes. Okay? They're not footnotes, they're side notes. Mm-hmm. Here, you've got other commentators. And in different tractates, you've got different commentators chosen by the publishers to occupy this space. Same thing is true on this side. In different editions of the Talmud, you have different commentaries that occupy this space. This one, this edition of the Schottenstein, actually does some that you don't normally have. You don't have it in that one. He brings you a lot of comparative sources in the Talmud itself, with a sort of citations. You don't have that in that edition of the Talmud. So that's what you're finding in these super commentaries, as they were there. Not the super commentaries which we refer to as these, but the super ones around the periphery. Okay? Okay. Now, comes this first Mishnah. If you are following it in the Talmud text, it's about a quarter of the way down the text. And the citation is Mem Taf Nun Yud. Mem Taf Nun Yud in the traditional text. With a little slash. It's an abbreviation for Maptita Matnita. Matnita is Aramaic for Mishnah. Okay? The Talmud is really made up of two languages, Hebrew and Aramaic. You have some Aramaic in the Mishnah, but the Mishnah is mostly Hebrew. The Bible is mostly Hebrew, but there are parts of the Bible that are also in Aramaic. Well, some of the latter books of the Bible. Okay? In the Gemara, those citations that are citations of the Tanaim, that is to say 200 and before, are usually but not always in Hebrew. Sometimes they'll be in Aramaic, but usually they're in Hebrew. Those comments, which date from 200 to 500, are nearly always in Aramaic. Right? Aramaic is a sister language to Hebrew, the way Spanish and Italian are to each other. They're almost comprehensible. Almost comprehensible. I remember going to museums in Italy where there are Spaniards who could almost understand the Italians who were the tour guides. And vice versa. There's a certain, it's almost there, but it's not there. It's not there. It's enough different so that it's really not there. But if you know Hebrew, you can almost make out Aramaic if you learn enough Aramaic. Grammar is somewhat different, and the vocabulary is also different. Okay, I mean, there's plenty of different vocabulary as well to Aramaic. So here the Matnita is the introduction now of the Mishnah. The Mishnah reads as follows. And I'm going to read it through and translate it. Probably won't have much of a chance to say anything about it beyond that. Kol mitzvot ben ala av anashim chayavim anashim peturot. Now, I'm going to do it literally. And when I do it literally, I will try to show you that it's hard to understand what it means. If it's not obvious that it's hard to understand, I'll translate a little. Kol mitzvot ben, all of the mitzvot of a son. Probably it means ben here. All of the mitzvot of a son. Al ha'av. Now, al ha'av literally is on the father. Toward the father. That happens to be wrong. See, you're an Israeli. You think you know Hebrew. Okay? But what you say is possible. You're right. You do know Hebrew. Okay? It's possible it could mean that. So, obviously, the Mishnah is not so simple to understand, even if you know Hebrew. So, all of the mitzvot of the son on the father, toward the father, for the father, from the father toward the child. Those are two opposite possibilities. But all of those are possible within the Hebrew. Anashim chayavim, men are obligated, the nashim peturot, and women are not obligated. Kol mitzvot ha'av ala ben, all of the mitzvot of the father on the son, Echad anashim, it is one for men, v'echad nashim, and one for women. Chayavim, they are all obligated. The chol mitzvot asei shazman grama, and all of the positive commandments, which are caused by time, anashim chayavim, men are obligated. Vinashim peturat, and women are not obligated. The chol mitzvot asei, and all of the positive commandments, shelo asman grama, which are not governed by time, echad anashim, it is the same for men, v'echad nashim, and it is the same for women, chayavim, they are all obligated. The chol mitzvot lo taseh, and all of the negative commandments, bein shehazman graman, whether they are relate, whether they are caused by time, ben shaloas mangrama, or whether they are not caused by time, echad anashim, it is the same for men, v'echad anashim, and it is the same for women, chayavim, they are all obligated. Chutz mibal takif, except for the law of thou shalt not cut around the sides of the head, uval tashchit, and thou shalt not destroy the hair on the side of the face, vabal titama lametim, and you shall not become defiled for the dead. All right, clear?
Little Egyptian boys.
What's that?
The little Egyptian boys.
Okay.
With their forelocks.
Okay. Now, that's the Mishnah. That's the Mishnah. As you can see, it's extraordinarily clear. Of course, it's not clear. A modern reader, to read something like that, it's nearly incomprehensible. I tried to read it to you in a very literal fashion, and there were several problems. One problem is that it's a foreign language, and you can never read a foreign language literally. Second problem is, even if you know the foreign language, you may not have any idea what it's saying, as we just encountered. You saw that. Thirdly, the subject matter is subject matter that presupposes a wide variety of technical terms. For example, mitzvot shazman grama, mitzvot that are caused by time, mitzvot asay, and mitzvot lot asay, positive commandments and negative commandments. We will have to define what those terms are. Thirdly, there is a presupposition here that there is a difference between men and women in terms of what they require. Then we see that there are intergenerational issues, and in a way they're opposite, or the Mishnah is setting us up for opposite issues. And the question is, if there is a difference between men and women, how does it work from going to the generation of parents toward children, and how does it work from the generation of children going toward parents? To what extent is it the same, and to what extent is it different? All that having been said, we finally defined the terms, more or less defined the terms. Mitzvot, if we could define the terms, and we will define those terms, of the mitzvot that are caused by time, and mitzvot not caused by time, we finally get to the end, we see that there's an exception to all of that. It's true, except, however, in the following cases. Okay? And the question will be, in all of this, how do you know any of this? How do you know this? Where do you get this knowledge from? Is Rabbi Judah the Prince telling us something that is perhaps an unbroken tradition from Moses on Mount Sinai? Is he conveying to us something that's the work of his generation, 5 generations, 10 generations, 20 generations? And how do we know? How do we know that? I'm raising theoretical questions. I want to raise another theoretical question. Those of you who have studied before should perhaps be sensitive to the fact that this is a very unusual Mishnah. If you compare it, for example, to the first Mishnah, Masechet Kiddushin, on which we were able to spend a whole year, Isha Niknet. Aisha niknet b'shalosh drachim v'kona et atzma b'shnei drachim niknet b'chesef b'shtaru b'viyah b'chesef b'et shamay omrim b'dinar v'shave dinar b'et shehilel omrim b'fruta v'shave pruta. Classic Mishnah is that you may have a statement and then you have b'et shamay says and b'et hillel says, or somebody says and somebody else says. In this Mishnah, there is absolutely no attribution to anybody. Okay? Now, there are other Mishnot like that. But the fact is that qualitatively, stylistically, That's an interesting fact. And when we're going to try to extrapolate now what the history of the Mishnah is, or what the theology of the Mishnah is, what it means, it's not irrelevant, it seems to me, to note the fact that it is said without any attribution to any rabbis whatsoever, that it is said just, this is the way it is, and that there are no arguments. Okay? Now, I've given you a very quick trip, for those of you who are new to this material, of what the Talmud is. I was glad to get to the substance of the material by the end, particularly for those of you for whom this was real review. And what we shall do next time is to go over this Mishnah, to deal with it in terms of the language very carefully, and then to move on from here to the Gemara, which elucidates this Mishnah, which really requires tremendous elucidation. Questions?
Yes. Just a comment, if people are interested in seeing written material from 200 CE, the Dead Sea Scrolls show is at the Jewish Museum.
Thank you.
Seeing things that are a couple of millennia old, including a pair of sandals, is really very, very powerful.
It is very powerful. Remember, in terms of what we were saying before, how limited we are in terms of texts to really understand, you know, if we wanted to know what did they say or what else was happening, all we have are some texts. Eventually we have the biblical texts, we have some apocryphal texts, we have these texts, we have some of the texts that have been discovered as in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and beyond that, it's all speculation. But fact is, we've got some of those things, and they're extraordinary to see, absolutely extraordinary. To be continued next week, same time, same place.
This is the book that you'll be getting, the one that you have here.
Exactly.
And this is